This week, gold was one of the few indexes to close in positive territory. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczyk, back with you for another Muy Grande-sized program. We've got top interviews from your favorite industry professionals, as well as the market headlines affecting your portfolio. The discussion kicks off this week with David McIlvaney. He expects 2015 to 2017 to be unlike anything we've seen in recent memory, an extremely challenging period for investors, particularly in the bond and stock markets. And you may have read that Bill Gross, actually the bond king, left PIMCO this week for its rival, Janus. More about that in a minute. Plus, massive liquidations of over-leveraged institutions could lead to financial carnage unlike anything witnessed in modern history. David finds, though, that precious metals equities are comparable in value to picking up gold at $270 an ounce way back in 2001. Valuations are irresistible. And a one-third portfolio allocation in precious metals, 30 to 40% is all we need to protect against the imminent stock and bond market collapses. That's more than double the high end that the typical financial advisor will recommend out there. Plus, Dr. Stephen Lieb from his New York City penthouse, he says that China is quietly accumulating a vast stockpile of gold in anticipation of a global gold standard. The near-term prospects for the U.S. stock market are fine, but the longer-term picture is potentially dangerous. He agrees with David McIlvaney that the bears are just looking for the perfect opportunity to pounce. And frustrated gold bulls should take solace from the HGX Housing Index recovery, where it took 3 years of selling and then three more years of backing and filling before a meaningful rally came to pass. And silver could even outperform gold. He's holding out for triple-digit silver, north of $100 an ounce, due in no small part to record demand for solar power and the photovoltaic revolution. The yellow metal could climb tenfold from these current prices within just 5 years' time. And the Gold Seek team wraps up with Robert Ian with yet another must-hear editorial. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Cloudy skies appeared over the gold market this week on U.S. equity strength and the remarkable greenback rally. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold finished near the break-even point, up slightly, around 12.15. Silver gave back only 25 cents, finishing at 17.54. However, silver aficionados are encouraged to take heart from the fact that the gold-to-silver ratio topped 70 this week, an extreme reading indicating that silver is a solid value relative to gold. The ratio bottomed at 35 back in 2011 when silver briefly touched $50 an ounce. Hat tip to our friend of the show, Vidya, for sending over a reminder here. The XAU Gold and Silver Index dropped about 3.5%. It was off 3 points at 83.52. Palladium gave back 35, closing near 783. Platinum was off 30, ending at 1302. But West Texas Intermediate crude bucked the trend, adding $1.77 per barrel, finishing at 93.54. Well, gold inched higher this week on global equities weakness and renewed tensions in the Middle East. Investors turned to the safe haven despite the unprecedented U.S. dollar rally, which continued its three-month advance, closing at yet another record high. Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Bahrain, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates joined forces with the U.S. with an orchestrated airstrike on militants reportedly in Syria this week. Although war tends to boost the precious metals prices, strength in the domestic economy continues to weigh heavily on the sector as investors brace for the end of QE stimulus and perhaps even higher rates. The national gross domestic product grew at about 4.6% on an annualized pace, higher than the anticipated 4.2 number against the backdrop of low inflation. The CPI was only 2% on an annualized basis. You might say this is the perfect melange for a dollar strength, and we've certainly seen that over a three-month rally. Well, central banks continue to use lower prices as an opportunity to increase gold stockpiles. Russia and Ukraine increased gold reserves in August, according to the International Monetary Fund. The IMF report also showed the Kyrgyz Republic and Kazakhstan, as well as Azerbaijan, also added to gold reserves for the month. Meanwhile, Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen said this week there are just simply too many people who want jobs but cannot find them, and too many who are working part-time but would prefer full-time work, and too many who are not searching for a job but would be if the labor market were stronger. I think this is a very impressive statement. Finally, a Fed chair who seems to have their focus on the middle class. Hat tip to Fed Chair Janet Yellen for these comments, and I think they're extremely apropos given the situation that I hear from other folks like myself, not to mention working class people. I mean, we're all in this boat together, and I just cannot underscore enough how impressed I am with these comments emerging from the Federal Reserve. Last week, the FOMC cut its monthly asset purchases by another $10 billion down to $15 billion, and of course, they're on track now to end the program next month. Policymakers also raised their medium estimate for the federal funds rate at the end of 2015 to around 1.4%. That's up slightly. Still, the Fed governors noted that rates would remain low for a considerable period. In 13 of the last 16 times that the Fed raised rates since World War II, the stock market corrected in the 6 months ahead of those increases. That's according to Sam Stovall. So, you know, folks really need to keep an eye on the stock market, because if you give this report any credit, and it seems pretty highly correlated there, one would expect a sharp bear market in equities to be indicative of higher rates. Or another way to look at it would just simply to be, if the Fed governors start to take a much more hawkish stance, look out below for equities. Bottom line on precious metals. Well, the big story continues to be the astounding dollar rally. I mean, the greenback has simply entered orbit over the past 3 months. Investors are unwinding dollar positions in a short squeeze scenario. Nevertheless, it is still doubtful that a meaningful uptrend will commence anytime soon. So once the dollar rally fails, which as I expect it to do, I think precious metals will likely snap back post-haste. And moving on to the Wall Street Report, cloudy skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week. Although the GDP numbers were positive, investors decided to focus instead on the threat of higher interest rates, as well as a loss of potential liquidity, a favorite market stimulus. For the week, the Dow Jones Industrials dropped about 166 points, around 1%, finishing at 17,279. The S&P 500 gave back about 27, finishing at 1982, while the NASDAQ gave back about 67, off 1.5%, finishing at 4579. Meanwhile, traders noted expectations that the central bank could raise rates sometime next year after winding down the bond buying program next month. Strong economic numbers suggest corporate earnings and the share prices, though, could remain elevated. Now, this has some investors in an ambiguous position. Some are bracing for greater price volatility in equities this year, but the big wild card still remains, and that's the interest rate situation at the Federal Reserve. Plus, we have considerable geopolitical instability that seems to seesaw or pendulum swing back and forth. Investors cited a number of reasons also behind the stock slide. Many attributed Russia's decision to potentially seize foreign assets. Others noted unease with the higher stock prices, which have had quite a substantial run over the last 5 years, and of course the monetary tightening. Meanwhile, one of the 30 Dow components, Nike, picked up more than 12% on the day. It blasted higher, unexpectedly, on record corporate profits. The chart is a sight to behold. BlackBerry also up over 5% on strong earnings results. Plus, an alpha stock candidate and recent pick blasted higher. Shares of Apple were up about 3%. Interesting, though, the FBI accosted the company for offering devices that make data untraceable for most current technologies, and I suppose there's really a dilemma there, dichotomy. On the one hand, folks need to be free. There needs to be freedom. And on the other hand, folks want safety. And in a side note, the bond king, Bill Gross at PIMCO, announced he is leaving the fund to work for rival fund firm Janus. So how badly did PIMCO drop the ball by pushing Bill Gross out of the door? Well, Janus Capital flew higher, get this, 43% on the news. While the company that demanded his departure, Alliance, lost over 6% on the same day. Well, the money says, folks, what were you thinking? Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, other than the prevailing price trend, my favorite market indicator, the 7-component fear index that we watch closely, reached an extreme fear level this week. And this is precisely what you'd want to see amid the accumulation that we're seeing in the charts. So you have a positive sentiment and somewhat positive technical. That's an interesting combination when you add in the positive fundamentals. All three. For the full report, including a daily stock, including the daily stock candidates and forecasts, I'd like for you to sign in to your Alpha Stocks newsletter report. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with must-hear discussions with David McIlvaney and Dr. Stephen Lee. More GoldSeek after this. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
It's a pleasure to welcome back David McIlvaney, President and CEO of the McIlvaney Financial Company and Director of the Swiss Corporation Global Gold. Welcome back to the show, Mr. McIlvaney.
Good to be with you.
As we were discussing before the broadcast today, we were talking about the Fed governors. They cut their monthly bond buying stimulus, as expected, another $10 billion, and that's down to about $15 billion per month from a peak of $85 billion, I guess, last year. They're still holding rates near zero, and of course, this will have profound, you know, implications on the markets in the months to come and maybe even for years to come. So I know listeners would really like to find out your comments and your thoughts on just what these FOMC moves could mean for their portfolio's bottom line, please.
Well, we assume that the Fed can do what they say they can do, and that's, I think, the problem. You've got two things going on. Number one, as you mentioned, the mortgage-backed securities and the Treasury purchases, those being tapered to zero at the end of October. There is going to be a different reality. Can those markets take care of themselves without outside stimulus? And that has yet to be proven. So my suspicion is that just like QE1 and QE2, there was a boost in the marketplaces in the context of QE1 and QE2, and as they dwindled, so did the asset prices that were commensurate there. And so I think we will see a drop in the stock market. I think we will see some pressure in the real estate market and equities both. The other issue is rates and the balance sheet. And raising rates and decreasing the balance sheet, those are pipe dreams. Those are pipe dreams. So again, they talk about one thing. Do they actually have the power to do it? $17.76 trillion in debt. Interest payments on that will rise with an increase in interest rates. While the Fed may talk about doing that, when you talk with Congress, the question is going to be, fiscally, can we afford an increase of 1%, 1.5%, 2%? What's the threshold before bankruptcy? And yeah, I don't think the threshold's very high, frankly, because $17.76 trillion is a lot of money, 6% debt growth this year with not a strong GDP growth to match it.
I feel that it's a topic that's flown under the radar screen. You'll recall that the tops that come to mind, Moody's, Fitch, and S&P. Now, I find it fascinating that of the three, at least to my knowledge now, S&P is the only agency to significantly lower the rating on U.S. debt. And I suspect that's going to change in the years to come for precisely the reasons that you've laid out here. Because folks have to start planning. What should investors be doing? What steps and contingencies can they be making now?
You know, frankly, I think owning gold is your contingency plan. It's insurance, as far as I'm concerned, in the idea that, again, just going back to the FOMC's own words, you know, they've basically said the Fed funds rate is going to be at 1.375 by the end of 2015 and 3.75 at the end of 2017, and they're going to use reverse repos as a part of their exit strategy. Say, can we afford the Fed funds rate at 3.75 with close to $18 trillion in debt, and we'll probably add at least another $500 billion next year? And the answer is a resounding no. So you can say whatever you want about the strategy that lies ahead. It's preposterous. And then to suggest that reverse repos are a part of an exit strategy, I'm just wondering if Janet Yellen even understands what a reverse repurchase agreement is. Because essentially what you do is you give an asset to a financial institution with the guarantee of buying back that asset at some point in the future. So you may have reduced your balance sheet with X exposure, but all you've done is substitute it with cash. That's the first issue. And the second issue is, just like a boomerang, that asset's coming right back to you, because the nature of a reverse repo is that you're going to buy it back. And so I'm just wondering about our leadership at the Fed, and I'm wondering if it's not any different than the types of decisions which were made by Greenspan and by Bernanke, supposedly solving problems when in fact what they were doing was laying the groundwork for the next major crisis. And I'm afraid that's what we have in front of us. So if you think there's the possibility that between government bureaucrats, Fed officials, and our leading economists that something happens in the next 6 to 12 months, then I again go back to, don't you want some insurance? Which boils down to one thing. You want ounces? You want more ounces? You want as many ounces as possible.
They've juiced the system. They have not addressed the problems that got us into the last crisis. I think you'd probably agree, back in 2007, 2008. In fact, they've just kind of painted over it. And unfortunately, the corrosion is now bursting through. And at some point, you know, the back of the vehicle might just crumble altogether. I mean, we are facing an even more frightening overall, at least, scenario in the economy. And for instance, as you pointed to, the housing market, you know, all they've done is really blown bubble 2.0. We have a mountain of debt that has not been addressed. And really, our top banks, financial institutions, are still carrying well in excess of $300 trillion of interest rate sensitive derivatives. So to me, it's an accident just, you know, looking for a piece of property to happen. What kind of timing are you putting on this? And that's a tricky question. You know, a lot of guests will shy away from it. I have a feeling that you have some parameters, a domain that you could put around this disaster that you see.
Well, sure. And I would suggest that for all the problems we've just described, one of the possible solutions is for us to grow our way out of it. We're not seeing real indications of that right now. In fact, the Rockefeller Institute just came out with a report showing for the most recent quarter, April to June of this year, personal income tax collections are declining sharply in nominal terms by 7%. And this is the first time since the fourth quarter of 2009 that state personal income tax revenue has declined for two consecutive quarters. We can grow our way out of it, but you're going to see an indication of that growth by, you know, an improvement in sort of people's bottom line. What are you bringing in an income? And if your income's not increasing, then I think you can assume that any growth we're seeing in the economy is not from sort of the nuts and bolts, healthy, sustainable, organic style of growth, but from added leverage, added debt to the system. And that is, in fact, what we're seeing happen. So, you know, I want to say, yes, there's great hope out there. On the other hand, we're going to have to see a lot more delivered for that hope to be realized. Time frame, I think 2015 to 2017 are going to represent something of a financial meat grinder. And in 2015 to 2017, I think investors need to ask themselves the question, to what degree do I intend to be grist in the mill? We've got the bond market, which is at an extreme level, both here and overseas, where people have been searching for yield and buying everything that wasn't nailed down in order to lock in their income needs, irrespective of the risk they were taking in terms of credit quality. You've got the stock market, which has more levered money in it than at any other time in world history. Okay, so if you're looking at margin debt as a percentage of GDP, In nominal terms, of course, it's much higher than it was in 1929. It's even higher than it was in 2000, 2007. At those peaks in the market, you've got more levered money in terms of margin debt today than you did then. But in all fairness, the economy's larger, the stock market's larger, and everything else. So as a percentage of GDP, it's north of 3%, which is the highest level in history. Where does this end? When does it end? To me, the margin numbers mean everything because the clock is already ticking. If we had $100 billion in margin debt, that'd be one thing. We've got over $460 billion in margin debt, which is clearly enough to get the enough of a snowball, if you will, to create a snowball effect and create a real avalanche of selling, of mass liquidations in the marketplace. Add to that the fact that you've got 60 to 80% of current volumes on the New York Stock Exchange coming from high-frequency trading, which, frankly, could care less if they're long or short, and I think all of a sudden the avalanche becomes something of sort of historical proportion. So when does that come unglued? It's borrowed money. It has to be paid back. Whoever's in those equity positions is paying 6 to 8% for the privilege of using borrowed money to speculate in the stock market. It literally, the clock is ticking. Anytime between now and the end of 2017, I think you've got a doozy, worse than 1929 potentially.
We have virtually marginal participation in this equities rally. And that's something that I think that should be the wake-up call for most investors out there, that really John Q. Public, the middle class, they don't have much skin in this game. And as a result, when the margin gets scared, when the hot money says, you know what, it looks like the downside is the play here. Contingency plans must be put in place here. And as you said earlier, one of the best, if not the best, is the precious metals market. And if nothing else, maybe diversifying or increasing exposure in one's portfolio substantially to gold and silver and related equities is at least one method for protecting what they've built up. So what I'd like to address now, if you don't mind, is the precious metals equities. My guess is you have some interesting thoughts there. There's, I guess, two ways to really look at what's happened in the last few years. It's been a very trying period for most people involved. But you might also say, well, there's opportunity here. I mean, we're seeing discounted prices. What's your take on the precious metals equities, please?
A purchase of precious metals equity should come with a bottle of Pepto-Bismol. I mean, I think that goes without saying. So think pink when you're thinking gold or silver in that regard. What we see in the precious metals equities are levels relative to gold comparable to 2000, 2001. And so from a relative standpoint, they're very inexpensive. If gold lingers here at these levels for 2-3 years, you probably lose a quarter to a third of the field through bankruptcy. I'm not sure that it's going to linger that long because, again, when you look at the equities market is kind of your litmus test for how the general public thinks, you know, things are going. And on the one hand, you can look at Gallup polls, which show 70% of people unhappy with the current state of the economy. And on the other hand, if you ask them how things are going and if they can point to anything solid that's favorable, they'll say, well, but the stock market's doing okay. And on that basis, you see stocks high, gold low. There's really no reason to own it in this environment. But I would contest that and say the day stock market rolls over, you're going to see people looking for safe havens. Treasuries may be a part of that. Dollars and cash may be a part of that. And I think gold and silver certainly will be as well. I have a hard time seeing that time clock go to sort of the critical 2-3 year period, which would cause, you know, a major winnowing of the field in the gold shares. Finding producers that have a low cost per ounce, you want people who can stay in case we're wrong on the timing. So that I think is worth considering. I own them. I've added to positions in the last 2 weeks. If we see prices diminish further, I mean, as a company, we added to positions in December, in January, and we're handsomely rewarded with some moves higher. And for shares that we owned at higher prices, of course, a recovery in value as we saw an increase from January to the mid-year. I think that's a little bit of a taste of what is to come. we may not be completely out of the woods yet, but I think for someone who takes a long view, not a trader's perspective, in it for a day, a week, a month, or even a year, but for someone who takes a long view and says, yeah, I think I like the direction of gold over the next 2, 3, 5 years, what you have with the miners is essentially a non-expiring call option on the price of gold. The problem with options is that time is against you, and you never know when the market's going to do what it's supposed to do. And if your timing's off, you lose everything. To own a miner is to own a non-expiring call option on the price of gold, and that's somewhat intriguing to me.
Well, you know, prediction, very tricky business, particularly when it regards the future, as it's been said. But I still would like to hear your thoughts regarding whether or not this could be the final move forward for equities. I'm not talking this week, this month, maybe even this year, but this primary push that we've seen, let's say from around 2009 until now, this 5-year equities rally, by some metrics, of course, one of the best rallies even since the 1920s, you could argue. The Dow is at an all-time, at least nominal, record high. The S&P 500 closing weekly record highs, maybe not today or this week, but in recent memory. So this is a unique time, and I don't think we've seen anything like this since the year 2000. But could this be a whole new, I don't know, inflationary paradigm shift, or could we be approaching a peak that our progeny will look back upon as the new 1929 market top?
Listen, I think the FOMC, they did not look at the Stock Traders Almanac for when they were winding down their quantitative easing 3 program. September and October historically are where you have significant crashes. You can look at a variety of periods and go back a long, long ways and see that. You had September 24th, 1869. You had the 1907 period, mid-October, after the Hepburn Act was put in place. You had 1929. You had, you know, the fall of 1987. You also have 2000 and 2007. I mean, over and over again, there's seasonal weakness, and the fact that they're pulling liquidity from the market in a period of seasonal weakness, I think, increases the probability that we are putting in a monumental peak here. Now, maybe they come out in 2015 with a new razzle-dazzle $5 trillion expansion of the balance sheet, double it from here. They can do that, and who knows what kind of rabbits they can pull out of the hat. We know that they can create trillions of dollars out of nothing. Maybe they can create rabbits ex nihilo as well. I think this is a terrible time to be pulling in their horns. Not that I liked what they were doing in the first place. I mean, frankly, I love Schumpeter's idea of creative destruction. I would have loved to see the 2008-2009 be a period where, you know, banks that didn't have any business being in business would be gone. So one of your questions about valuations and your comment, too, that 2000 was really the number to shoot for, because 2000 was the highest we've ever seen the stock market in terms of fundamental valuation metrics, far beyond 1929, far beyond 1987, even far beyond 2007. But 2014 is running neck and neck with those levels of highest valuation, the only period in U.S. financial history where the stock market has had higher valuations. If you're looking at price earnings or cyclically adjusted price earnings, yes, you've got to go to the year 2000. Now, maybe we're not to those levels, but we're marching ever closer. How close do you have to get to something that is objectively noted before you say again, here we are again?
These levels, these valuations are being cajoled by more than just hot money here in the United States. I mean, we, at least for quite some time, there was some flight away from Europe, not only due to the fact that they have a comparatively sluggish economy, but we also had the Ukraine-Russia drama, did we not? And that, of course, caused a lot of investors to scratch their heads, look around, where can we go? Well, we don't want to miss the party in the U.S. equities market. What do you think?
Yeah, it's fascinating to me that this era of investors is somewhat blind to various risks that need to be accommodated in a portfolio. You have inflation risk, you have deflation risk, you have volatility, you have liquidity risk, you have geopolitical risk, you have even domestic political risk, where policies can change and adversely impact a company or their program for growth. You've got uncertainty related to regulations and taxes. All of these things need to be present in an investor's mind. It's not sort of put your money down as you would in Vegas and roll the dice. There is actually a thoughtful process that goes into successful value investing. And in this environment, to ignore something as blatant as geopolitical risk, whether it's conflict in the Middle East, I mean, we're dropping bombs in the last couple of days, and no one really seems to care. Basically, put Russia in a very interesting and awkward position by bringing NATO forces to their doorstep. I mean, if you roll the clock back, if you look as a student of history and say, you know, what kept the French out of Russia? What kept the Germans out of Russia? It was this thousand-mile barrier, land barrier, that we just shrunk by putting a U.S. oriented leadership in the Ukraine. Is it reasonable for them? Let's not even say reasonable. Can we understand why they would be agitated? Yes, we can understand why they would be agitated. All I'm saying is that the markets have not taken any of this into consideration, and it's as if central bank activity is the silver bullet and the cure-all for everything. As long as the ECB, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, and the Fed are willing to print like mad, there is nothing that can happen in the world which will disturb us, because we know the central bankers have our backs. And I'm telling you, this is very much like the prisoner's dilemma. The prisoner's dilemma is like when the players in a game, everyone knows they have to stay in for it to continue to work. But everyone also knows that they may want to be the person who gets out. Does this make sense? The system works as long as no one breaks from the system, but to avoid being in the system as it's breaking down, you have to be the first one to break out. What we're doing is the world of traders and professional money managers are all assuming that they are the guy who's going to get out. But everyone's still in, and everyone's still in because the central bank continues to promise the sun, moon, and stars, and when the Fed stops to promise the sun, moon, and stars, the ECB takes the baton and takes it a little bit further. This, to me, is one of the most perilous times of investing in certainly my lifetime, and our family's been doing this for several generations. I'd have to say risk is undervalued, underappreciated, and underinsured in a major, major way.
You started off the point with what I think is the most important key concept that I hope listeners take away from this discussion. This lack of understanding, even misconception, with regard to the components that we must have in a portfolio. And what's happened is we're victims of our own success. At least I think that's one aspect to this story. And what I mean by success is that, well, we've had this amazing contrived period that's been fomented by the FOMC, the ECB, and others around the world, and that has helped us to recover, of course, from the Great Recession. I mean, I don't even hear the term thrown around much anymore. Just a few years ago, we were all talking about it. Well, it seems to have been relegated to the past so quickly because of the liquidity and the rest of the measures that have been taken. Back on point, though, your family have been in this industry for so long, and so you would be well-versed in the understanding that a solid portfolio must be made up of much more than just the traditional stocks and bonds. I mean, you need international exposure, you need commodities, precious metals, so many components. Why don't I let you have the floor here to give people just maybe a basic overview of what they need to be considering now, other than just 5 or 10% precious metals weighting. Maybe that weighting should be higher.
And if we go too fast, our website has something that I think is particularly helpful. We call it our perspective triangle, and we go into an in-depth discussion of what that is. I'll give the brief version here, and for anyone interested, McIlvaney.com is a helpful resource on that particular issue. Look for the perspective triangle in the resources section. You know, you're asking your assets to do certain things for you, and I think as you're diversifying a portfolio, you need to be very clear on what the mandates are that you're giving your assets. I talk about gold and silver as an insurance policy because that's the role they play in a portfolio. That, to us, is the basis. It's like the foundation of a portfolio. Now, beyond an insurance measure, which may replace lost purchasing power or compensate for market volatility in other assets that you own with an increase in value given the stress and strain in the stock market, bond market, real estate markets, what have you, that insurance component is very critical. You move to another category, what we would describe, again, by its mandate, liquidity. This could be cash. This could be cash equivalents. Why do you have it? Well, if there's an immediate opportunity that you can only take advantage of by writing a check, yes, you need instant liquidity. But what about managing a household or managing a business? Yes, you have to have adequate liquidity. If you don't have adequate liquidity, you can find yourself going from liquidity crisis to solvency crisis very quickly. So insurance is one thing you have to adequately address. Precious metals does that. Liquidity is another component that you have to address. Cash or cash equivalents addresses that. The growth elements are where Wall Street tends to hang their hats and say, listen, you've got some money and you want more. Well, that's pretty basic. That's pretty basic, and it appeals to sort of our instinct to greed. And so everyone gets slammed into a growth category by and large. And then as you get older, they moderate that somewhat and say, you also need some income. You know, listen, I think Warren Buffett's genius is not in being a value investor. His genius is in having a predictable and consistent income stream, which allows him to recharge and go play again and recharge and play again. So, you know, yes, you can wait around for growth, particularly when you get to average your cost down, knowing that you've got more income coming in that allows you to add to liquidity and, again, recharge your portfolio at a lower cost basis. So I think if you would look at all of his purchases of equities, you would find that Warren Buffett has actually done pretty well in large part because he lowered his cost basis. He didn't always get it right. He didn't call it the right day, the perfect day, buying on the day that a particular equity traded at its lowest. But by focusing on income in tandem with growth, he was able to accomplish quite a bit. But again, liquidity and insurance next to growth and income, these are the mandates that the perspective triangle tries to, quote-unquote, add perspective to. And I would say in this environment, you could have as much as one-third of your liquid assets in precious metals. Now, one-third, I think, is more than adequate to accomplish, again, risk mitigation in terms of volatility of price in the general equities market, the bond market, the real estate market, and to compensate for loss in purchasing power in your cash equivalent liquidity position. So if you want more than a third, be my guest, but you're going to have that much more volatility, both up and down, and I don't think it's necessary. It's adequate as an insurance policy to max out at about a third.
David McElvaney, we want to thank you for taking time for us today. Would you like to share any contact information for our listeners to direct their web browsers, the services that you provide, and any other contact information, please?
Well, thank you. McElvaney.com is the easiest place to find us. That's M-C-A-L-V, as in Victor, A-N-Y. .com, McElvaney.com. Every Wednesday we do a market commentary. You know, certainly not to compete with yours. Yours is an excellent program. We listen to it, and but it's very broad based. Politics, geopolitics, economics, finance. Try to cover quite a bit of ground in that 30 to 45 minutes of audio commentary each Wednesday, and you can subscribe for free at McElvaney.com. Would encourage you to do that.
All right, David McElvaney. We're going to look forward to having you back on Gold. Seek.com radio.
Thank you, sir.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of Gold Seek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant cave KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Dr. Stephen Lieb has over a quarter century of investment experience, author of seven bestsellers, including The Oil Factor, The Coming Economic Collapse, and Game Over, his latest threat alert, How China's Growing Prosperity Threatens the American Way of Life. Welcome back, Dr. Lieb.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's always a pleasure.
Start off today with some of the topicality. For instance, there's been, well, the geopolitical situation, at least for a while, was red hot.
Obviously, you have a, I think they call it a caliphate or caliphate or however you pronounce it, that is now occupying about a third of Iraq and, you know, a big chunk of Syria. It appears, you know, they're extremists to the extreme, every bit as extreme as Al-Qaeda, of which they're an offshoot, and they're self-financing, and it's clear that they have their eyes set on places like Saudi Arabia. They're Sunni, and the Saudis are Sunni. And the Saudis are a bifurcated society. About two-thirds of the Saudis are wealthy. Another third are Sunnis and not very wealthy. So they're in a position to recruit and to make a lot of trouble in a lot of the Middle East. And it would be very silly to take these people as, you know, just another threat. Basically, America has said they're not going to put feet on the ground or foot boots on the ground, and airstrikes are not, you know, they may contain them to some extent, but they're not going to diminish their recruiting efforts. If anything, they may strengthen their recruiting efforts. And I think our response to the crisis so far, arming the so-called Syrian rebels, is ridiculous. I mean, it's just like, it's like we're trying to beat ourselves. I mean, you're arming pharmacists and proprietors of dry cleaning shops, et cetera, and these weapons are almost surely going to end up in the hands of the militants. So I think there is a lot to worry about geopolitically. The fact that it hasn't yet hurt oil prices and that commodities have been under some pressure, you know, this doesn't mean too much. I mean, this is a world, and it's always been the stock market and the world we've been in for a long time to come, for a long time, at least in most of my lifetime, has always been a world that can change dramatically. Markets can change dramatically. I won't say overnight, but they can change dramatically in a very, very short period of time. So I think it's a mistake to write off, you know, what's happening in the Middle East as not, you know, important geopolitically. It is. It's exceptionally important. If this group of militants can start recruiting Sunnis from, you know, all parts of the Middle East, it could be very, very important. And I just don't see any real hope of gathering a Middle East army against them. I mean, they represent, you know, the same kinds of thinking that a lot of Middle Easterners believe in, unfortunately, very unfortunately. And I just don't think that we get it. I really don't. I don't think you're going to see the Turks fighting against them. I don't think you're going to see any real boots on the ground. I think that, you know, what we're doing with airstrikes is about what we're going to end up doing, and I don't think that's really going to stop them, unfortunately.
I know that listeners will want to hear the panacea that you are proposing that is contrary to our officials' current plan of action.
My panacea would be probably feet on the ground, boots on the ground, but unfortunately, it may be too late in the day. I mean, we sort of wasted that alternative when we went into Iraq the first time. Our panacea right now, I mean, I wouldn't call it a panacea, is to keep our fingers crossed, toes crossed, and everything crossed, that Iraq can form a government and that government can run an army. But that's really a long shot, because you're asking a government that's headed by a Shiite to unite a country that is filled with very, very strong beliefs that, of which, you know, only part are Shiites. You need Sunnis and you need Kurds behind you, and it's going to be very, very difficult to, you know, have a united government under those conditions. But that has to be the panacea. Whatever we can do to, you know, forward that, that would be great. If the Iraqi army is able to, be a real force against this collection of militants, that would be great. But other than that, I think that's last I heard that the new government, they finally have gotten rid of Maliki, thank goodness. But the new government is headed by a bright guy. There's no doubt about it. But they still don't have a defense minister. Now, how are you going to fight a war without a defense minister? I mean, it strikes me that's a pretty important position to fill. You know, I'm not saying it looks hopeless at this point, but it doesn't look great. I mean, you know, panacea would be further protection, further monies to help the Saudis along in terms of protecting their assets. But my gosh, how much more money can we give them? I mean, you know, it's just not a good situation, and it's a situation that I think people have to be aware of. In the sense that it can change, it could change overnight, or not overnight, but over a period of not too long a period, it could change and, you know, change for the worse.
Don't you feel that our allies, however weak those ties may have become in recent decades due to our own actions, at least partially, the concerted, unified action to stabilize the Middle East. I mean, for instance, one of our top allies, Israel, could be jeopardized if this situation becomes even more unstable.
Israel's very worried about this. I mean, they've said as much. I mean, they said this is one of the reasons that they're not going after Hamas as aggressively as they were. Because this is a threat. It's a threat to the entire Middle East. There's no doubt about it. Look, the Middle East is a highly fractured place. I mean, you know, the Arab Spring, I mean, you know, it proves it, the failure of it. And now you have this group springing up that, you know, controls vast amounts of territory, self-funding, and has aspirations that, you know, basically include everything. So it's, you know, what can Israel do? I mean, you know, not a whole lot, and I haven't even mentioned Iran. I mean, you know, the Iranians would be a natural foe to these people because the Iranians are Shiites and these people are Sunnis. And the Iranians, they could do something. If their feet were on the ground and they were marching with the Iraqis, that would mean something. But the Iranians, in my opinion, and I think they've said as much already, would want they basically would want permission de facto. That's what they're saying. They're not saying it in so many words, but they're saying it in effect. They want permission to build a nuclear bomb in order to help with these people. So I mean, you know, talk about being caught between a rock and a hard place. There you are. I mean, do you let the Iranians build a nuclear bomb so that they'll help you? Maybe help you against this group of militants, or do you just let the group of militants run on and hope that the Iraqis themselves can assemble an army? And, you know, let's not forget, and you mentioned Israel before. I mean, I think that Israel, if they sensed that the Iranians were building a nuclear bomb, I think they'd take action. This is not something that has simple solutions. There are no simple solutions. There are no panaceas. This is a long time in the making. And it's a pox on a lot of people's houses, not just Bush, but a lot of people, not just Obama, but a lot of people. There's been, you know, a lot of drop balls here. Their deal with us is that they won't. I don't think that Iran, despite all their flamboyant protestations, et cetera, is really so much interested in Europe or interested in Israel. I think they're much more interested in Saudi Arabia. And I think that, a nuclear-armed Iran would, you know, basically make them, you know, king of the Middle East. So, I mean, would you rather have Iran or would you rather have this militant group? Now, if Iran did become nuclear-armed, then I think you'd have Israel dropping tactical nuclear weapons to try and destroy the Iranian nuclear capacity. And, you know, then that just becomes a holy mess of all sorts. You know, it's just terrible. I mean, I wish I could put a better spin on it, but... you know, this is why I advise, or one of the reasons I advise almost everybody, or everybody, in fact, not almost everybody, but anyone that, you know, can, that I think they've got to have precious metals, gold, et cetera, in their portfolios. I think it's an absolute necessity, Chris, absolute necessity. And we're not even talking about the role Russia plays with Iran. Russia has a major role in the Iranian nuclear plans. I mean, they're the ones that supply Iran. And, you know, the United States is basically, its hegemony is a thing of the past. That's the bottom line here. There's no doubt about it in my mind. I mean, even militarily, as we're talking now, what we're talking now is basic geopolitical military terms, and how helpless the United States is in the face of this situation. And a country that I think emerges kind of unharmed here and in a very, very much stronger position than they've ever been is China. That spells gold standard to me. You know, I know I'm jumping around a little bit here, but it's all the more reason for investors to hold precious metals. I mean, yeah, they've been disappointing. And, gosh, I mean, I started writing a publication. I think the first issue was around 1978. I think the Dow was around 800 at that time. And, you know, all I could say is that there's no downside in this market. And basically I was right, but I said there's massive upside, but I couldn't say when. And, you know, it took 4 years, but I was right. I was right. So, I mean, I think in gold there's as much upside in gold as there was in the Dow when it was at 800. Literally, I think gold could go up 10 or 15 fold because you're going to have to, you know, whatever currency, however it's used, there's going to have to be enough of it in value to back up all international trade, and that takes you 10 or 15 times higher than what it is today. Then you might be able to, you know, get somewhere in the world. Because then all of a sudden, you know, you're talking about actors becomes much broader, becomes in, yeah, I mean, you have a much broader range of players to choose from. It's not like the United States on its own, which is really the case today. It could be the United States, China, Russia, who knows? Everybody could be on their own, but it would be under a different kind of monetary regime and a different kind of worldwide regime, and one in which China, I think, might play the prominent part. That's where I think we're headed.
You brought up some great points, and you talked about the precious metals. But, you know, the investment du jour is still equities and bonds.
It was in 2007, too. And, you know, and it may remain the, you know, look, I'm not bearish on stocks at all here. I think stocks will go higher. And you know, my perspective here is not, you know, 2 or 3 months. It really is, you know, the next several years. So, yeah, I totally agree that the investment du jour is, in fact, stocks. And I think it's likely to remain stocks for some time to come. But that does not in any way mean that in 5 years stocks are going to be higher than they are today and gold's going to be, you know, lower. No, I think that if your perspective is a little bit longer term, you really want to talk about precious metals and gold.
Absolutely. And, of course, that's music to the ears of our listeners. But at the same time, I think for 5 years now, since, as you mentioned, the bottom there, the nadir of the bear market, the Great Recession, stocks just simply have chugged along. And we have seen, as I'm sure you know, an awful lot of stock repurchases by top corporations, and this reduces the supply. They're buying back their own shares, supporting their stock price. This has been a theme that we've seen. We see a very robust IPO market. You know, the Alibaba, just one of the latest and a long litany of companies to go public with success. And I guess you can really look at it from two perspectives, can't you? I mean, these are the hallmarks of a bull market, but they can also be viewed as, from a contrarian perspective, as a bit frothy. What's your take?
I don't think it's anything's happening here that's frothy. I'm not bearish on the market at all here. In fact, I would say I'm kind of bullish on the market, but I'm talking longer term. You know, sometimes, very rarely are there bells and whistles to tell you that the market's going to go down 30 or 40 or 50%. I don't think that's around the corner right now. I think that I would be a little bit concerned about bonds. I think they're getting a little bit frothy here, but I think that, you know, stocks can go higher. I mean, there's massive amounts of money out there, and I think stocks will go higher. But, you know, you're talking about the geopolitical events, and how they're eventually going to play out, I think it's going to end in tears. That's the way I see it. It will, I think, end in tears. And I'm not going to try and time it. But I think that, you know, it will end. And when it ends, it'll end very, very badly. And I think very badly for the U.S. And I think that, you know, from a 5 or 10 year perspective, even less than 10, 5 year perspective, precious metals will dramatically outperform stocks, dramatically, not even in the same ballpark, dramatically.
But, you know, Dr. Lieb, I'm asking guests to prognosticate a bit, keeping in mind the adage, you know, prediction is fraught with difficulties, particularly when it regards the future. Because I think that you have the perspective and the wherewithal to tackle this question. I'd like to know whether or not you view this as the next ultimate zenith. Is this going to be the peak that our progeny looks back in equities, U.S. equities, as that 1929 moment, or perhaps the ultimate zenith?
That comes around to, you know, whether an asteroid's going to strike the Earth. I don't think civilization's going to disappear. But I think that, you know, most historians, I think, would agree that, you know, China's been the number one civilization and economy for 16 out of the last 18 centuries. And I don't think China wants to make it 16 out of 19. So I think that there's been a massive move to the from west to east, and that move is in terms of economic power, in terms of military power, and certainly in terms of, I think, monetary power now. I mean, all the trading in gold is basically going to end up in yuan. So, you know, once China starts, once gold starts being denominated in yuan, and then, you know, the Chinese are in a position to say, well, here we have a currency. We're the biggest trader in the world right now. And now we're going to back our currency up with gold. It's already denominated in yuan. You know, and the dollar is sitting here, you know, where you've got $4 trillion in the Federal Reserve Bank backed up by nothing. And you've got real wages in this country having declined at least since the beginning of this century. Some people argue since 1970. And, you know, basically you have a very, very strong stock market. There's no doubt you do. But I don't think that's going to carry the day. I mean, you know, so what? I mean, you know, you've had a few people get extremely wealthy. I don't think that that's an argument for, you know, a country's infrastructure, a country's ability to, you know, run itself. I mean, our energy policy, I think, is a catastrophe in this country. I don't think we're doing anything with regard to renewable energies to speak of, whereas China, Germany, and other countries are doing much, much, much more. And it's just not a situation that I think can end, you know, well for us. I mean, eventually it may. When you say, is it an ultimate zenith? I think it's going to be a major top. And I think it's going to be a real blow, not just a shot across the bow, but it will hit hard. And I think for a while, America will play second fiddle in the world in a lot of ways. That doesn't mean that we can't come back. I think there's a great spirit that underlies this country. I love this country. But I think that we became way too complacent, and I think we're going to pay for that. That doesn't mean that we're going to pay forever. That doesn't mean that our progeny's progeny are going to look back at these times and say, well, this was the end of America as they knew it. No, I'm not that smart. I can't look that far ahead, but I can say that, you know, we're living through a point of inflection right now. Okay. And it's not too hard to get the stock market to go up when you control money presses. It is hard to get real wages to go up, however, and we're not succeeding there at all. In fact, we're failing miserably. And it's real wages that, you know, is affecting 90-95% of the population. They're not benefiting. So when you say the stock market's going up, to me that's not a good argument for, you know, what's happening in the world today.
Very good. Well, I love to hear that term, inflection point. And another function, another term from calculus, we're talking about how these geopolitical events come together in a single function and affect the markets.
I mean, you know, basically Russia got exactly what they wanted. That was, you know, I think a sign of weakness in the United States. I mean, Russia did exactly what they wanted, really didn't miss a beat doing it. And that's tragic. I mean, it's totally tragic, but they did. And I think the United States facilitated it. I think that basically by, you know, initially supporting the Ukraine, well, I, you know, we're getting off topic here, but by initially supporting the people in, what, Madden Square, as strong as they did, I think that they led to the fleeing of the then president of Ukraine and, you know, some sort of chaos, and then that allowed Russia to take over the Crimea or gave them an excuse to do that. And then, you know, we've tried slapping sanctions on them, and they sort of laughed at those sanctions and slapped their own sanctions. And now what you have is Russia's been free to move their troops into the eastern part of the country, and you'll have some sort of federalism there. And I don't think Russia, I don't think has any plans right now to annex the Ukraine. But, you know, after Obama's, you know, threats once, after the threats following the takeover of the Crimea, it just has to strike you. It's a frisson of fear and agony when you see him in Estonia assuring, you know, this Baltic state that, you know, NATO's behind them. And the Estonians saying, you know, we don't want NATO here. We don't want to tempt the Russians. So, I mean, this is just not the sign of a great power succeeding. This is a sign of a power, you know, basically falling backwards. And then the same power is fighting, you know, this situation in the Middle East, et cetera, while China continues to motor along. So, you know, what more can I say? I wish it were this way.
You seem to imply here that Russia is the biggest victor, but, you know, some of our guests have pointed to the oil companies having, Western oil companies having infused many of their executives and some of our political leaders into the region, and I'm referring to Ukraine, and how that seems to be a victory on their behalf. Any comments?
Well, Western oil companies, yeah, I mean, they never lose. They're just worldwide oil companies domiciled in the U.S. They're not going to lose. But that's not a victory for the U.S. I mean, that's a victory for, you know, a particular segment of U.S. industry, right? I mean, that's, you know, yeah, they could benefit in certain ways. I don't think they're going to benefit much from being in the Ukraine, but they may benefit. It's hard. The big beneficiary here is obviously China. I mean, you know, the message here to Russia is that you've got to look toward the south, toward your south, or partially south anyway, toward China, not toward Europe. And that's what they've done. I mean, who knows how much gas and oil they've agreed to send and trade with China. But it's, you know, it's a significant fraction of $1 trillion, if not a trillion. And, you know, at the same time, China's buying Russian gold mines and investing in Russian oil companies. So, you know, the real victor here is not Western oil companies. It's really China.
Very good. Well, let's shift gears back to the precious metals market. And, you know, we've seen some interesting developments in the markets, a lot of weakness lately. And it appears to be setting up a potential capitulation moment, if you will, or a scenario at least where the final holdouts toss up their hands, the weak hands say, I can't take any more pain. And the deep pockets come in and say, okay, this is what we've been waiting for. This is the, well, as you say, the inflection point. And, we see a sea change in sentiment from that point forward. Do you see something like that on the radar screen for us?
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me in any way, shape, or form to see something like that occur. I mean, some sort of, you know, real final shakeout and then, you know, see precious metals come back. What complicates things a little bit here, Chris, is that, you know, we're talking about precious metals as measured in dollars. And, you know, more and more, I think, as I said before, I think they're going to be measured in yuan. So it's going to depend upon, you know, yeah, you might get a shakeout from the dollar holders, but you're certainly not going to get a shakeout from the yuan holders. I mean, you know, they're probably going to buy. So I don't know whether you're going to see some sort of final shakeout or capitulation, or you're going to see something like you saw in 1982 in the stock market. I mean, if you remember back in 1982, I'm sure you don't, you're too young, but I wasn't, and I lived through it, and everybody was looking at, you know, bottoms, 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 and you never got a bottom. And then one day, I think on a Friday or Monday or whatever, market just shot up out of nowhere. I mean, you know, I think Henry Kaufman and Wozenlauer, they changed their view on interest rates or something like that. I mean, it wasn't much of a catalyst, but there was really no capitulation. There could be some capitulation. I'm not ruling it out, but I'm saying that if you're waiting for that moment to invest, don't.
That's interesting, too, because we also saw signs of that in the HGX Philadelphia Housing Index. You know, we had a three-year decline. We may have approached 90% on the downside from peak to trough. Yeah, but then you know what? We never really had anything after that. We had three sine wave years of just consolidation back and forth. And what if we had something similar here in the precious metal?
You hit the nail on the head. I mean, you can't really, you know, describe what a bottom is going to look like. What you can do, I think, with some certainty or some degree of assurance is say that gold, yeah, it could go down a little bit more, maybe another 10% from here. But, you know, the upside is just dramatically higher than the downside. And, you know, the shape and scope of its bottom, I don't think that's the game to play here. I think the game to play here is, again, to recognize the shift in the world from west to east and to know that, you know, the real winning investments in that shift will be precious metals, real objects, commodities, et cetera. Listen, because I do believe in what I'm saying, and I, you know, I'm in this business to try and help people. But
you're not selling anything, and that's what I appreciate. Yeah, you're not pandering to the audience here. You have nothing to gain. Why don't I give you a chance here to give folks your takeaway point?
Well, I think I've shared, you know, most of my, you know, longer-term beliefs. I'm writing a book on, you know, gold-related investments and why I think it's critical to own them. I mean, that book will probably won't be published for at least a year. And, you know, that's one of my core beliefs. And, you know, I do want to say without any guile whatsoever that I hope that I'm dead wrong, that I hope that, you know, something comes out of the woodwork that I'm completely unaware of and makes me look like an idiot in advocating these kinds of positions because, you know, I don't like it. You know, I don't like to see our country on the edge and between a rock and a hard place and, you know, all those other things that I've said. I don't like saying them. I don't like feeling them. But that basically is what I feel right now. And I think that everybody would be well advised having some gold and other gold correlated investments in their portfolio. How much, you know, that's up to them to decide. But I think it's a very, very good idea to do.
Very good. And do you have any words of wisdom or consolation for those of us who have held out in the silver camp during three brutal years?
Silver will go dramatically higher. I mean, I think silver will outperform gold. I think the recent breakdown in silver was kind of silly. I mean, it went through a support zone and everyone sold. It's ridiculous. There's a company, you know, it's impossible to buy this company, but I look at it from time to time. It's called Giga Solar, and they sell solar panels into China. And they may sell them into other countries, too. But, I mean, they're going gangbusters. So, you know, the demand for silver is there. It's going to increase steadily, industrial demand, that is. And I think that the investment demand is obviously going to increase if I'm right on gold. So, yeah, I think silver is going to probably outperform or at least perform as well as gold, if not outperform gold going forward. So I wouldn't pay too much attention to this recent breakdown in silver. I think it has no meaning whatsoever. This doesn't mean silver can't go to $15, but I mean, I think, you know, I think silver will end up being a three-digit metal well past $100 in most of our lifetimes. Maybe not mine, but within the next 5 years, I think you'll see silver in three digits.
Well, we certainly hope that is the case, that you will enjoy many, many decades to come with silver in the triple-digit zone. That's going to please all of us.
Yes, I think you will see that.
Dr. Stephen Lee, we know your schedule is quite busy and you've been gracious with your time. Oh, and look forward to your wonderful upcoming Precious Metals book. I know listeners will want to get a
copy. As I said, you have about a year or so to wait, but yes. And it's a book like a lot of books I've written. I hope I'm dead wrong. But I don't see anything right now to say I am. So I would, again, advise people to own precious metals and assets that are correlated with precious metals, silver, gold, and, you know, whatever else. Thank you so much, Chris.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Several weeks ago, I mentioned a family reunion my wife and I attended. Heading home, we took a little side trip and visited, of all things, an ostrich ranch. In addition to the different animals, there were, of course, ostriches. Which reminded me of the proverbial person who sticks their head in the sand when faced with a challenge or confrontation. So many people, as they approach success, do things to sabotage that success because they feel they do not deserve that success. People in romantic relationships will blow up the relationship just as it's getting serious to avoid commitment. People will sabotage a business deal because somewhere deep down they don't believe they deserve the riches that success will bring them. It happens over and over again. Maybe it's happening to you right now. Gold is in the low 1200s. Silver is under 1875. These are fire sale prices compared to where the metal has traded in recent years. Well below the all-in cash cost of many mines. Yet even the staunchest gold and silver bugs have a hard time buying when prices are this low. Most will wait until silver is well back on its way into the mid-20s, and gold breaks $1,500 to jump back onto the bandwagon. Why is this? If you listen to the growing firestorm of experts, most are predicting significant prices by the end of this year and early next as the markets collapse and wars escalate. Harvey Organ is predicting silver could reach $200 an ounce by December or January, and gold could approach $10,000 if the COMEX collapses. Banks are beginning to send out, in mass, pre-approved credit applications for small businesses for $10,000 to $100,000 lines of credit. It would be interesting to know if bail-ins are ever enacted, if the bank could levy your open credit line and saddle you with more debt to bail in the bank. Reading the fine print on all applications going forward is a must-do for anyone considering a bank loan of any kind. When I speak at conferences, my bio says that since 2007, I have openly discussed a variety of scenarios that would result in a return to the gold standard for the U.S. dollar and the likelihood of multiple reserve currencies on a regional basis throughout the world, backed in part or whole by gold. The various currency alliances we are witnessing between countries like Russia and China, as an example, I believe, are a prelude to the establishment of multiple reserve currencies that will ultimately be backed in part or whole by gold. Accompanied, of course, by a whole lot of war and conflict. Now is not the time to put one's head in the sand, or believe you are not worthy of the success and freedom you intuitively know you deserve. The choice is yours. Chris, I'll be hosting the first ever Liberty Mastermind webinar on September 24th. Registration is free and details are on my website. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.